journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, July 29th, 2011, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Afghanistan's southern provinces descend into the worst violence of the year. Chris Hedges on fundamentalism in the U.S. in the wake of the Norway attacks, and California Assembly member Mike Davis on prison-based gerrymandering, plus rethink reviews. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. At least 17 people were killed this morning in Afghanistan when a minibus drove over a roadside bomb in the southern Helmand province. Among them were women and children. The violence comes just a day after a triple suicide bombing and shooting in neighboring Uruzgan province claimed the lives of at least 19 people. Among them was a BBC reporter, Omid Kapulwak, and 12 children between the ages of 4 and 13, according to Reuters. The Taliban took credit for the Uruzgan attacks, one of which was aimed at the security offices of Matiullah Khan, a prominent warlord and U.S. ally who provides protection for NATO convoys traveling from Uruzgan to Kandahar. Khan escaped harm, however. The attacks come in the same week as the assassination of the mayor of Kandahar, a province just south of Uruzgan, and the traditional stronghold of the Taliban. Ghulam Haider Hamidi was killed on Wednesday by a suicide bomber who entered his heavily fortified compound with a bomb in his turban. Hamidi worked as an accountant in Northern Virginia here in the U.S. for 18 years before leaving for Afghanistan in 2007 to become Kandahar's mayor. His death is the latest in a string of assassinations of major political figures in and around Kandahar province to be killed in just the past 2.5 weeks. Ahmed Wali Karzai, the half-brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Kandahar's most powerful warlord, was fatally shot on July 12th, followed by the suicide bomb assassination of the cleric Hikmatullah Hikmat, the head of the Provincial Ulema Council, just 2 days later at Karzai's funeral. Kandahar, the southernmost province which shares a border with Pakistan, is considered the most dangerous in Afghanistan. It is not yet clear who is responsible for Mayor Hamidi's murder this week. In fact, the forces arrayed against the central Afghan government and their U.S. and NATO benefactors seem to be spreading faster, even to the capital, Kabul. On July 17th, a key senior advisor to President Hamid Karzai and former governor of Uruzgan province, John Muhammad Khan, was killed by armed men at his home in Kabul. Muhammad Hashim Watanwal, a member of the Afghan parliament, was killed alongside him. Well, despite mounting evidence to the contrary, Ryan Crocker, the new U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, claimed in his first press briefing this week that the assassinations actually represent a sign of weakness for the Taliban.
They've had to kind of regroup and figure out what they can do. And in some cases, that has been assassination. Again, we saw a very similar pattern in Iraq. Clearly, these are horrific attacks. But they can also be interpreted as a sign of significant organizational weakness.
And that is Ryan Crocker, the new U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Joining me on the phone this morning is Con Hallinan. He is a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. He's been following the situation in Afghanistan for quite some time. Welcome to Uprising, Con.
Thanks for having me.
It's hard to keep track of all of the violence that has been plaguing the southern provinces in Afghanistan and even the capital, Kabul, just over these past 2.5 weeks. In terms of the killings that we're seeing in Kandahar and the statement you just heard from Ryan Crocker, how do you respond to his assessment that this actually means the Taliban is getting weaker?
Well, this was very much the same line that the Bush administration had when the insurgency was going in Iraq. I think the term they used then was dead-enders, that this was a sort of an act of desperation by the by the insurgency. What's happened in the southern provinces is that the Taliban have done the sort of classic maneuver that every successful guerrilla force does, which is that when large numbers of troops poured into Helmand and Kandahar province, which is where the center of the Pushtun insurgency is, then what happened is those groups, they are either moved out of the area and went into other areas of Afghanistan, where we've seen much more activity in the east and activity in the north where it didn't occur before, and then essentially shifted their tactics from fighting to roadside bombs and to assassinations. I mean, it's a pretty standard line. It's the Ho Chi Minh's old line that where the enemy is strong, you disperse. Where the enemy is weak, you concentrate. And that's what's going on in Kandahar right now. And it's a sign of basically the failure of not only the counterinsurgency operation, but for that matter, the counterterrorism operation, which is what has sort of centered the tactics over the past 6 months.
Now, the country has been plagued with the worst violence in a very, very long time. There was a report in the middle of the year by the United Nations that the number of Afghan civilians killed in war-related violence rose 15% in the first half of 2011, and that nearly 1,500 Afghan civilians have already lost their lives, and this is likely not even counting this latest violence. This is the year that the U.S. is supposed to be handing over power. U.S. and NATO are supposed to be handing over power, some power, to Afghan forces. How do you analyze these statistics?
Well, you know, this step up in civilian casualties is in partly reflects a kind of different strategy by the insurgents. And rather than getting themselves involved in firefights with U.S. and NATO troops and the Afghan army troops, they've fallen back more and more on roadside bombs, because if you've got a lot of highly trained and well armed people in your region, you don't get in firefights with them. You pick another way to do it, and so most of these civilian casualties have come at the expense of the Afghan civilian population. Although NATO. NATO killing of civilians from airstrikes is up about 15% as well.
And you don't hear that being reported very much.
No, you don't hear that reported. And what it doesn't say is it says, well, you know, the insurgents are responsible for this. They're the ones who's inflicting the casualties. Actually, what's happening is that the United States got very sophisticated in terms of figuring out these roadside bombs. And most roadside bombs were set off electronically. People use a cell phone. They would use some sort of electronic device to set it off. And the Americans developed ways to intercept that, and essentially spot it and block it from happening. And so the insurgency shifted over to a much more old-fashioned method, which was pressure plates. And now what you have to do is sort of like the old-fashioned landmine.
Hmm.
You have to step on it, and it goes off. Well, that's going to mean that roadside bombs are more indiscriminate. On the other hand, the complaints to the insurgents that they're using this method and instead they should be using the old method is, it's essentially telling the insurgents, fight the way we want you to fight, don't fight the way you want to fight. And that's not the way guerrilla war works. So even the step up in Afghan civilians really has to be laid at the feet of the allies, not at the feet of the insurgency. I mean, this was a natural evolution of that kind of that style of fighting.
Now, Khan, every time we hear about these attacks, news reporters and writers try to, and so does the military, try to address whether the Taliban is responsible, whether they took responsibility or not. Does it make sense anymore to differentiate between the Taliban and other armed forces that are targeting the U.S. and NATO? Because if these attacks are so widespread and coming one after another, is it worthwhile to even ask if the Taliban's behind it or if it means that the Taliban's growing stronger or weaker? Is it just a question of anti-U.S. and NATO armed opposition in general growing stronger, which the Taliban just may be one part of?
Well, it's both, really. What's happened is that the Taliban today is a much more dispersed organization than it was in 2001 when the U.S. invaded. And that's largely because one of the things that the U.S. has done, and particularly in the last couple of years, is to target the Taliban leadership. And it's done it with these night raids and these drone attacks and all this kind of stuff. And so what's happened is you've developed a sort of secondary leadership. And the secondary leadership is much less disciplined. It's much less it doesn't rely on the traditional kind of a Taliban leadership. So it's a much more dispersed organization, and it is a much more dispersed organization even politically. I mean, in some places the Taliban will be banning schools, and other places they'll be encouraging schools. In some places they'll be banning television, and some places they'll be giving a green light on television. So there's that, and it is kind of spread all over the place. Then on top of that, you do have a couple of other groups, too, because you do have the Haqqani group, which is really very different than the Taliban. They're allied with the Taliban, and they have been, at least in certain Kandahar provinces, they've been most effective in terms of the insurgency. And then you have Hekmatyar's Islamic Party as well. So it's a, you know, it's a complex mélange out there. I mean, that's the point that the Americans have never come to grip with, is that they're fighting a group of people that are very complex and range from, you know, university intellectuals to landless peasants.
And also what you point out in your article on the assassination of Ahmad Wali Karzai that happened a couple of weeks ago is that there is, it's almost as though while the Taliban and other insurgent groups are fighting for the U.S. and NATO to leave, because it's sort of a given now that they are eventually going to leave, putting power in the hands of the central government, that there is the war against the central government in full swing, a war that will continue whether the U.S. is there or not. And in fact, we sort of can expect it to continue once the U.S. and NATO leave.
I don't think there's any question about that, although the presence of NATO and the U.S. make it very difficult to take the step that needs to be taken.
The whole justification that if the U.S. leaves, there's going to be civil war, it seems moot because there is a war already.
There is a war going on. And in fact, if you look at the polls, what you find in Afghanistan is that the Taliban does not have widespread support. 12% is generally the figure that you see. But there's an overwhelming support, like a little over 60%. For people to have a coalition government. So people want a negotiation, and they want the Taliban included in the government. I think one of the myths about Afghans is that they're generally talked about as if they're very warlike. Really what they are is they're very negotiate type. They manage to try to avoid war among themselves by negotiating agreements. And they get these jirgas together, and people cut a deal is basically what happens. And what you're finding is that if they don't cut a deal, then they're quite fierce when it comes to warfare. But it's not their first choice. What's happening here is that NATO and the U.S. is pushing the Afghans in this direction of sort of continuing the war rather than backing up and looking for a negotiated settlement. The ground rules for a negotiated settlement are there. They have been there, since 2007. I mean, the proposals that were made by the Taliban are probably the place it's going to end up in any case. So there's really no reason for the current surge going on. There's no reason for the current fighting going on. And the people that are really suffering from this are the Afghan people themselves.
My guest is Khan Hallin, and he is a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. We're talking about the surge, to use that term, in violence in Afghanistan just in the past couple of weeks. Well, what you're saying is leads me to ask the question that if the Taliban themselves are not that popular, they only sort of command about a 12%, 10 to 12% support in Afghanistan, the U.S. and NATO continued presence can only serve to strengthen that support because the Taliban are seen as against the U.S. and NATO. If the U.S. and NATO were not there, it's not necessarily true that there would be peace in Afghanistan, but it seems that the Taliban may not, you know, their support may be overwhelmed by support for alternative groups. And so the U.S.'s sheer presence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's any question that's true. I think you put that exactly correctly. The thing which is sort of fueling the Taliban at this point is the occupation, is the war, is the ongoing war. And that if that were removed, if you would stop this aggressive patrolling, if you would pull back troops to barracks and basically agree to negotiate with all partners. I mean, everybody's got to be there. I mean, it's got to be everybody who's a stakeholder has to be at the table, including some of the surrounding countries like Iran, Pakistan, India, China, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc. All of those countries have to have a kind of seat at this table because everybody else there has some interest. A primary interest are what the Afghans are going to do themselves. And I think that that war could be over very quickly. I mean, I think that we've gotten into this idea that this is a country of endless war where people just love to fight. It's not true. The Afghans don't love to fight. It's just that people keep invading their country.
However, it should be mentioned. It should be mentioned that there are some pretty bloodthirsty warlords who have been our proxies, our guys for decades, and they're not just going to sit at a table. You know, they command armed militias. They're not going to sit at a table with ordinary Afghans who may want their rights. You know, I think it'll probably be more complicated than that. And I want to, you know, focus specifically on Kandahar and just the last few minutes of our conversation because you wrote about what happened there and what happens in Kandahar. It really may be a bellwether for what happens in the rest of the country. With Ahmad Wali Karzai, the central government's main representative, the de facto governor, killed a couple of weeks ago, with the mayor recently killed. What is happening to the central government's power in Kandahar? Is there a sense that the political vacuum, the power vacuum left behind, is being filled?
Well, it's right now there's a scramble to see who fills it. And because what happened is that that Karzai represented one of the big tribes, basically three big tribes in the Kandahar province. And he represented one of those tribes. And those tribes have been traditionally enemies of the Taliban. The Taliban, it comes from, even though that's their base in Kandahar, it comes from a collection of smaller tribes. So some of this is very, very internal. I mean, it didn't even have to do with, you know, issues like Islam and everything. It really had to do with resistance to the control of these three big tribes. And what's happened now is that there's going to be a scramble for power among these power brokers. And, of course, the mayor of Kandahar was just recently assassinated. So what I think is that what you're going to see is a lot of kind of bloody internecine warfare going on here. And I think the attack on the Kandahar mayor, the assassination of the Kandahar mayor, may or may not have been Taliban. I mean, that could have been someone in one of the other tribes.
And in fact, the person who killed Ahmad Wali Karzai was a close friend of his, or ally at least, and not at least openly a member of the Taliban.
Right, and we don't know whether he was a Taliban or not. In a sense, though, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference because the Taliban says, you know, we did it, and everybody believes that, particularly since they've successfully made a number of other assassinations in the area. So I think what you're going to have is that you're going to have this kind of, you know, settling of who's going to be in power, sort of like what happens in the mafia, you know, when somebody gets knocked off and then the families go into a period of civil war to see who ends up as the, you know, the capo, you're going to see a very similar thing going on here in Kandahar, which weakens the central government, which, you know, puts the United States in a position of where what they're basically doing is fighting a war while their allies are, you know, are carrying out you know, mob hits against one another in order to control the markets and control particularly the transportation.
Which is essentially a repeat of things past, which means that this last 10 years of war in the U.S. has only served to keep things pretty much the same. Con Halinan,
exactly the same.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we will link to your article on the killing of Ahmad Wali Karzai from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Con Hallinan is a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus, and you can read his writings at fpif.org. This is Uprising. We've been talking about Afghanistan. We'll go to the issue of Norway, but as it relates to, as the attacks in Norway relate to U.S. fundamentalism, after this short break with my guest Chris Hedges. We'll also hear this week's Rethink Reviews with Jonathan Kim. And then California Assemblyman Mike Davis joins us in studio to discuss prison-based gerrymandering and a bill that he is sponsoring to address it. Stay tuned.
Actor and activist Danny Glover will speak at a public forum on Haiti on Sunday, July 31st, 1:30 to 4 p.m. in L.A. at the Southern California Library. Other speakers include Pierre Lebossier of Haiti Action Committee and Robert Roth of Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. Get info on the significance and victory of President Aristide's return, ongoing work of the grassroots, role of U.N. forces and NGOs, recent fraudulent elections, tent city evictions, cholera, and how you can help the Haitian grassroots. Also, Gadi Fou, drumming and dancing by Gafu Ensemble. Event called by Haiti Working Group LA. Refreshments, childcare, wheelchair accessible, Spanish translation. Donations welcome. No one turned away. Sunday, July 31st, 1:30 to 4 p.m. at the Southern California Library, 6120 South Vermont Avenue, LA 90044. More information is available at 323-276-9833 or at kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Bulls on Parade by Rage Against the Machine here on Uprising. Rage Against the Machine will be headlining a major concert tomorrow called LA Rising with Muse, Lauryn Hill, El Gran Silencio, Rise Against, and Immortal Technique at the LA Coliseum at 3 p.m. We have two pairs of tickets to give to the first two callers who can tell us correctly the names of the current bass guitarist and the current drummer in Rage Against the Machine. The first two callers who can answer correctly who Rage Against the Machine's bass guitarist and drummer are at 818-985-5735 will win a pair of tickets to the LA Rising concert. This is your last chance to win tickets to LA Rising here on Uprising, and it's the only live appearance tomorrow by Rage Against the Machine in the U.S. all year. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Anders Behring Breivik set off a car bomb and killed more than 70 people in a village near Oslo, Norway, exactly 1 week ago today. Breivik has been charged under the Terrorism Act, which has a maximum prison term of 21 years. The right-wing Norwegian wrote his 1,500-page manifesto outlining his beliefs online. He was motivated by a fundamentalist ideology, claiming to want to, quote, save Europe against cultural Marxism and Islamization. In an article posted on truthdig.com titled Fundamentalism Kills, author and analyst Chris Hedges explores the parallels between Breivik's ideology and American fundamentalism, which in his view is not a simple opposition between Western civilization and Islam, rather, quote, between those who embrace the rational and those who believe in biblical myth. An interview published this week by the Southern Poverty Law Center of a former Department of Homeland Security analyst Daryl Johnson revealed that a DHS unit responsible for investigating non-Islamic threats in the U.S. was dismantled. This happened after the DHS was heavily criticized for a 2009 report on right-wing terrorism in the U.S. Chris Hedges was a foreign correspondent for two decades. He's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a columnist for truthdig.com. His latest book is called The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. He joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, when you hear the media coverage here in the U.S., there's not that much of the Norway attacks. How do you assess the way in which American mainstream media and commentators are viewing this attack?
Well, I think they're complicitous in peddling this frightening sort of ideology and demonization of Muslims in the Muslim world. Fifth of the world's population, most of whom, I would remind your listeners, are not even Arab. And as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East, I think that this bigoted, racist filth has leached into the mainstream. It's, of course, peddled by the Christian right, but it's also peddled by new atheists like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens. I think it informs the caricature we have of Muslims across the political and cultural spectrum. And when you demonize or dehumanize a group, when you externalize evil so that a certain religious body or ethnic group is, in essence, infected by this virus of evil from which they cannot free themselves, it sets up inevitably a kind of road towards violence, which is what we saw. And I worry with the current economic morass that we have stumbled into, the inability on the part of the Obama administration to respond to the very real suffering of the poor and working men and women in this country. And now, of course, we're about to see a catastrophic assault this October against the last programs that are between tens of millions of Americans in real, real despair and suffering, that this kind of virulent reaction, this kind of scapegoating of Muslims or undocumented workers could begin to see the similar acts of violence within the United States.
So the differentiation that we see being made between Anders Breivik, who because of his violence can be characterized as a lone wolf, a crazy, insane fanatic, and between the sort of rational critics of Islam like Sam Harris, you're saying that differentiation is really not valid?
No, I don't consider Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens a rational critic of Islam. These people are secular fundamentalists. They use the language of scientific rationalism and the exaltation of Western civilization to justify, in the case of Harris, in his book The End of Faith, he actually asks us to consider carrying out a nuclear first strike on the Arab world. The language is just as repugnant as that employed by the Christian right. And I don't want to pick on Harris too much because this is just done now routinely within the American media, within any kind of civil discourse within this country when we talk about the Muslim world. And it is a dangerous kind of fundamentalism. It is reducing a varied culture with different languages and histories and outlooks to this kind of monolithic evil that only responds to violence. Fundamentalists all belong to the same subset. I don't care whether they're Christian or Jewish or Muslim, and it can certainly come in secular form. And I think that we are as guilty of embracing this fundamentalist mindset as the very forces that we have pitted ourselves against.
Well, just staying on Sam Harris for a minute, because he did respond to your article, Fundamentalism Kills, where you critique him, and you've critiqued him in the past. He takes issue with the fact that you have said that he calls for a nuclear first strike against the Arab world. What I found, I should say, amusing, although what he says isn't amusing, but it was interesting to see him quote himself from the book that he wrote, The End of Faith, to try to prove that you are wrong. But my reading of his quote pretty much confirms what you say, that he has called for first strike against against Muslims, a nuclear first strike against Muslims, if, you know, some radical Islamic group or whatever have nuclear weapons.
The book, which I had to read before I debated him at Royce Hall at UCLA, is filled with this kind of really racist cant. You know, things like we're at the word war with Islam, and the quote that you said, which people can read online. You know, there's really not much he can do because he wrote it.
And he does us a favor by reprinting it from his book.
No, I mean, you know, what he did is try and sort of bold or highlight a few words here and there, but mm-hmm. the quote is the quote, and I used it accurately and fully. I didn't in any way cut it within my article, but he, within that book, and again, this is just twinned with the kind of language of Christian fundamentalists, says that we may just have to get used to the fact that we'll have to kill people for what they believe. That's not an exact quote, but that's the idea. Readers can go and see it for themselves. He calls the Quran he says it mandates such hatred. He said the problem with Islam is Islam himself. He writes that Islam, more than any other religion human beings have devised, has all the markings of a thoroughgoing cult of death. I mean, on and on and on and on. And look, the Christian right uses this language and worse. The point in pulling out Harris is to make it clear, I think, to readers that we're not simply talking about religious bigots, we're talking about secular bigots. And this is extremely dangerous when societies break down. You know, inevitably those dark demagogic forces, and we're already seeing that within the lunatic fringe of our political establishment, target scapegoats. They target those who are weak and marginal within a society. And I think first on the list is Muslims, although certainly these fanatics have a long list. Undocumented workers are second, but you can put women on there, homosexuals, liberals, intellectuals, I mean, on and on and on. I watched the disintegration of Yugoslavia as a reporter for the New York Times. I covered the war there. I know how these things work. I know how in times of turmoil and economic crisis, these very frightening figures are vomited up, and I don't think that this language is in any way benign. First get people to speak in the language of hate and violence before you get them to carry out acts of hate and violence.
What about the fact that the wars being carried out by the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan, the U.S. war in Iraq, which have killed so many civilians, should be also seen as a manifestation of Islamophobia? And a lot of these folks, liberal, even Democrats, and certainly Republicans who say they're secular, try to distance themselves from right-wing anti-Muslim ideology, but at the same time support wars that kill Muslim civilians.
Well, that's right. And they have bought into this fallacy that somehow we can use the 101st Airborne to instill virtues mm-hmm. in occupied populations. I mean, every time I hear somebody talk about liberating women in Afghanistan, I want to get up and leap across the table. As if once you start employing hellfire missiles and tow missiles and brutal effects of industrial warfare, you can even discuss human rights. And you're right, this has just been embraced across the political spectrum, including self-identified liberals. And the fact is, preemptive war, which all of these forces call for and support, is illegal under international law. It is defined by the post-Nuremberg laws as a criminal war of aggression. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is that we have no right as a nation to debate the terms of these occupations. And you don't hear that. We have committed war crimes and atrocities and frankly, acts of state terrorism that dwarf anything ever carried out by al-Qaeda, including 9/11.
And so in many ways, this Norwegian right-winger is an extreme manifestation, expression of the Western government, as well as media and individual attacks on and extreme right-wing attacks on Muslims to, you know, which makes the so-called war of civilizations, clash of civilizations, gives it a kind of legitimacy. It doesn't seem in the grand scheme of things that he stands out very much, despite the horrific acts he committed.
In terms of his ideology.
Yes, exactly.
No, his ideology, that's the point. His ideology has been embraced by the mainstream, and far more in the United States than it has in Europe, where there's still a few voices of sanity. And when societies begin to disintegrate, this externalization of evil and this demand that certain people, to steal a line from Marcel Proust, are not infected with vices that can be cured, but viruses that are endemic to them because of who they are, then you cross a very, very dangerous line, and you essentially set up ideological foundations by which the extermination of others is legitimate.
Well, Chris Hedges, it's always great to have you on, to have you share your insights with us. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonali.
Chris Hedges is a writer. His many books include The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. That's his latest. He's a senior fellow at the Nation Institute, a columnist for TruthDig.com. He was a foreign correspondent for 2 decades, wrote for the New York Times and other media institutions. And his article, Fundamentalism Kills, can be found on TruthDig.com. This is Uprising. After this week's Rethink Reviews, Assemblyman Mike Davis joins us in studio to discuss his bill AB 420. Stay tuned.
I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
When you say your prayers tonight, this is what you should be saying to yourself. Latif Yahya is dead. Now, I'm Uday Saddam Hussein.
Imagine if the cruelest, most psychotic gangster on earth chose you to be his body double and impersonator, to fill in at public appearances and be a target for would-be assassins. Now imagine he also wanted to be your best friend, and that he'd kill your family if you refused. Now imagine this deadly mental case's father was the dictator of an oil-rich Middle Eastern country, and you have The Devil's Double, an extraordinary new film based on the true story of Latif Yahya, an Iraqi soldier who was chosen in the late 80s to be the double of Uday Hussein, the sadistic eldest son of Saddam Hussein. The Devil's Double is probably the best film I've seen all year, and that's largely due to the truly astonishing performance of Dominic Cooper, who plays both Uday and Latif in what has got to be one of the most mesmerizing performances in movie history. No, I am not exaggerating. Films like The Social Network have shown us that advances in digital filmmaking have made it possible to convincingly have one actor play 2 characters on screen. But Dominic Cooper's riveting performance takes this to a new level, as he not only plays a homicidal nutbag and the man he's essentially taken hostage, but also the hostage trying to impersonate the homicidal nutbag. Cooper's performances as Latif and Uday are so radically different and the technology so seamless that you'll quickly and easily accept that these are 2 completely different people. And if you do find yourself pondering the fact that Uday and Latif are played by the same actor, you'll probably be thinking, man, those effects are amazing, and or, I cannot believe how incredible this Dominic Cooper guy is. Where did he come from?
Come on, tell me.
Shape of face, hair, nose, physique, all in the high 90s.
Good.
Your eyes are 5 millimeters bigger. They can use makeup.
And the teeth. What about the teeth?
Well, he came from England, where the handsome, ripped 33-year-old has quickly been distinguishing himself as one of the most promising talents of a generation, with standout roles in British theater and TV, and recently in successful films like In Education, Mamma Mia, and Captain America. Trust me, you're going to be hearing a lot more about this guy. The bright, widescreen digital cinematography gives the opulent settings the slick feel of a modern-day rap or gangster video, juiced with over-the-top 80s extravagance. When violence comes in The Devil's Double, it's always shocking and often heartbreaking. Uday, as a character, is one of the most terrifying, repugnant movie villains of all time. A murderous, self-obsessed, unrepentant rapist and torturer who's completely untouchable.
I will never let you go. I will never let you go.
In the eyes of his victims, we not only see their pain, but the pain Uday's existence causes the people of Iraq. Latif is utterly sympathetic as a good man forced to become the man he despises, just hoping to survive with his soul intact. Perhaps my only quarrel with The Devil's Double is French actress Ludivine Sagnier, who plays Uday's favorite girl, who quickly falls for Latif. While this might have happened in real life, it's a bit cliché, And while Sanye is good at playing super sexy and is apparently a good actress, she does slow things down later in the film. But that takes little away from this remarkable movie that could be classified as a gangster, spy, serial killer, kidnapping, love triangle, political, historical, mafia, Hitchcockian action thriller. Again, I'm not exaggerating. Dominic Cooper gives what is quite possibly the greatest performance I've ever seen, making The Devil's Double feel not only like a quantum leap for digital filmmaking and genre, but of the possibilities of acting, with Cooper achieving something that will be studied and admired for generations to come. The Devil's Double is rated R and opens today in New York and Los Angeles. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink Review for Uprising.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. At a time when California prisons and redistricting are much debated issues, a new state bill seeks to address a problem at the intersection of the two, prison-based gerrymandering. Described as representation without population, prison-based gerrymandering occurs when prisoners are counted for census purposes in the district their prison is located. Opponents say this artificially inflates the population of districts where prisons are built and dilutes the number of prisons, the numbers in prisoners' hometowns. The Prison Policy Initiative, or PPI, estimates the 2010 census counted 2 million Americans in the wrong place because of the practice, not just in California, but all over the nation. A stark example of the consequences can be found in Omarosa County, Iowa. The PPI reports one Omarosa district has an official population of about 1,374 residents. The prison within its boundaries houses 1,321 adults who cannot vote, but who provide 96% of the district's population. According to the PPI, the remaining residents have 25 times more voting power than residents in neighboring districts. In 2008, the U.S. Department of Justice pegged the California prison population at 173,000 prisoners, many of them residing in facilities hundreds of miles from their last known address. The NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund argues the practice, quote, severely weakens the voting strength of entire communities of color in California. It reports African Americans and Latinos make up 43.3% of the state's population and a disproportionate 70% of state prisoners. California Assemblyman Mike Davis is the author of Assembly Bill 420, which would require the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to submit last known addresses of all inmates to the Redistricting Commission. AB 420 has made it through the Assembly and will come before the state Senate when it reconvenes in August. Assemblyman Davis is from the 48th District here in Los Angeles. He is also the vice chair of the Legislative Black Caucus and also a member of the Assembly Rules Committee, in addition to others, and he serves as Assistant Majority Whip. He also joins me in studio now. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, is this how the census has always worked? Has the census always essentially counted prisoners where they are being housed rather than where their addresses were before they were imprisoned?
Well, the state law in California under Election Code Section 2025 requires specifically that in the state of California, those who are in prison shall be counted in the communities that they come from as opposed to the areas where they are serving their sentence. Unfortunately, the Census Department in Washington counts prisoners in the areas where they are incarcerated. And when they turn over that data to states, it is the responsibility of the states to transform that data within compliance of their own laws. Hmm. Unfortunately, in California, that has not been done. And so, no, it has not been required by our state constitution to count them in their prisons, but they have followed the policy of a federal department, but that is not federal law.
And is it common in other states to count prisoners' addresses properly?
Properly, yes. Mm-hmm. But there have been instances of improper counting, and quite actually, there are three states that have transformed from prison gerrymandering to a correct count. Those states are New York, Delaware, and Maryland. And my bill, AB 420, asks California to stop prison gerrymandering and to join those other three states in our country that have transformed from an incorrect count to following their own state policy. This is what we're asking California to do, mm-hmm. to follow its own constitution provision provided in our election code, section 2025, that says in the state of California, if there is a prisoner, that person is to be counted for the purpose of redistricting in his community.
Redistricting can always be a very emotional issue. It can be a very important issue for civil rights. On our program just yesterday, we covered the controversies around the Redistricting Commission here in Southern California with a number of districts. We also covered the prisoner hunger strike. This issue of counting people where their last known address was would not even be such an enormous issue if we weren't imprisoning so many people. And so when we are imprisoning over 150,000 people in California alone, then it starts to affect numbers in districts.
Absolutely. In fact, over 160,000. But when we further look at over that 160,000 prisoners in California, the proportion of those, as you have stated earlier, that happen to be minority. And we look at 37% of the population that is a Latino in the state of California, and 37% of the men in prison are Latino. But equally important, of the 6.2% of African-Americans in the state of California, over 28% of the 160,000 prisoners are African-American. And so when they are counted in the areas where they are incarcerated, as opposed to the communities where they live, we have a negative impact upon minority leadership and representation in the state of California. And so it is important. I would say to you that when we look at the dramatic example of the negative impact in the state legislature, in the assembly in particular, we have 465,000 constituents each or somewhere therein. However, we have one assembly district, Assembly District 30, that has over 40,000 prisoners,
wow.
which means that in violation of the 14th Amendment, which provides that every level of government in this country, the representatives in those bodies should represent the same approximate amount of constituents. In other words, the person in Assembly District 30 represents some 420,000, while the majority of the state assembly represents some 465,000. And so that is the dramatic example, not only in Iowa, but right here in the state of California, and how prison gerrymandering has a negative impact upon fair and equal representation.
So if your bill, AB 420, does pass the state Senate, if it's signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown, what would it require the Redistricting Commission to do? Would it be the commission that would be charged with counting people in the proper districts?
Absolutely, because in court, in accordance with California's recent provision that the the redistricting committee count, this will ask them to count correctly according to existing California law. Prisoners for the purpose of redistricting where they live, not where they are incarcerated. Also, I would add to you, in Los Angeles County, 30% of the prison population comes from Los Angeles County. When we look at programs that have state and federal funds, the average sentence of a prisoner is not life in prison. It's 2 to 3 years. And so if we have programs providing resources and services where prisoners who are returning home in 2 to 3 years, those funds are not available to counties like Los Angeles to provide those services. So for the next 8 or 7 years, we are not getting the kind of funding in many instances when this prison gerrymandering count has its impact. It would be negative, even on local communities.
What is the state of voting rights for prisoners in the state of California?
Well, I want to say that the purpose of redistricting is not to evaluate the voting status mm-hmm. of an individual. For example, I have children who are part of my 465 constituents as an assembly member. They can't vote, but they are part of that base. I have people who might be developmentally disabled, who might not can't vote, but they are equally a part of my 465,000 constituents. And so the voting status of prisoners is not the core value of the purpose as to why we count. However, there are some individuals that have been described as individuals who can vote, who are in the prison population, though that is not the purpose as to why we count them in the redistricting mm-hmm. process.
So on the one hand, having prisoners' address be counted as where they're imprisoned rather than where they were living before imprisonment, having that be the state, which is what it is now, that negatively impacts the districts that they did reside in. But then how does it disproportionately empower the districts where the prisons are built?
Because what we're saying conceptually is that those who have prisons in their districts, that your vote is more important. You talked about the example in Iowa where the council district had some 1,300, yet one of those districts, only 50 people decided who the councilman was.
Because those were the only people who could vote.
That's correct. And I use a very, not extreme, but I guess you could say it's an extreme example here in California in the legislature. We have one member that has over 40,000 captive constituents. What I mean by that, these people who are counted as his constituents in prison can't go to the library. They can't go to the park. Yet they are counted as constituents, over 40,000 of them.
So this particular person who needs to win votes doesn't have to worry about 40,000 of those winning those 40,000 votes. He has fewer votes. He or she would have fewer votes to have to contend with winning to get their seat.
And he sits in a body where his colleagues have 40,000 real constituents and not captive constituents. And so it violates the provision that the 14th Amendment provides in this country, that all representatives in political bodies should represent approximately the same amount. So what I'm saying in summary is you don't have the same amount or anywhere near in representation, and it's in violation of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution.
My guest is Assemblyman Mike Davis. He represents the 48th District here in Los Angeles. He's vice chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, also a member of the Assembly Rules Committee, serves as the Assistant Majority Whip. We're talking about Assembly Bill 420, which would require the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to submit the last known addresses of all inmates to the Redistricting Commission in order for their addresses to be counted as being those that they occupied before they were imprisoned. So what is the prospect? What are the prospects for this bill to actually become law right now?
We are very fortunate to have successfully sent the message of the negative impact of prison gerrymandering, coupled with the fact we are fortunate that other states in this country have stood up, the state of New York, the state of Delaware, the state of Maryland, to say that we want a democracy that is inclusive of all of our citizens. And we are asking that everyone call their state senator in the state of California to support this concept that is fair, that is just, that sends the core value of inclusiveness as opposed to making sure that we exclude individuals and that we follow the 14th Amendment of the Constitution for fair representation. The prospects are great that California's state Senate would join the lower house, the state assembly, and making sure that we put an end to prison gerrymandering in the state of California.
And what are you calling on listeners to do if they support the bill? And I should mention among the supporters of the bill are the California Association of Black Pastors, SEIU Local 1000, Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, Common Cause, including the City of Pasadena and the Congress of California Seniors. So it seems to have a broad base of support. What are you calling on listeners to do?
I'm asking listeners to support AB 420 by calling their state senator and wherever they are located throughout the state to ask him or her to vote in support of AB 420 ending prison gerrymandering in the state of California.
And so at this point, because it is going to be facing the state Senate in August, that's where the support is needed the most.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask you, broadly speaking, in terms of the issue of redistricting, here in Southern California, you represent a district here in Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles itself has been changing as the 2010 census shows. LA's population grew less than the rest of the state. There's a lot of migration. The economy has affected particularly communities of color disproportionately. Do you see the efforts by the Redistricting Commission, the kinds of things that you're working on with this prison gerrymandering issue to try to strengthen voting rights, particularly of communities of color in Los Angeles, as we head into what might be a dangerous time for minorities here, being hit by the recession, increasing xenophobia on many levels. How do you foresee the future in terms of voting rights for people of color?
I think that integrity is a core value that must exist if we are to have fairness and justice. When we look at, in terms of redistricting, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in this country, it started because specifically African Americans were excluded. Some of the questions that will be asked this time in terms of representation, when we look at prison gerrymandering that you and I have just discussed, and the fact that we know our existing state code asks for us to count them in their communities, and we have not, what does that say about integrity or the lack of it? When you ask me about representation of minorities, these are going to be the questions. This issue that the Justice Department has raised over the years about making sure that language minorities, those who speak foreign languages, get equal access to materials they need to vote. But equally, there are going to be some questions about the terms of cracking and packing. What has been done in terms of drawing the lines that has separated minority communities? And have we in any way tried to put them all in one corner to make them less effective, putting them in districts of over 50% or under 50% and grouping them in with others? Have we in California, because we are unique, attempted to make multicultural districts? Or because we're California, have we chosen to create bicultural districts, therefore creating more conflict among minorities? These are unique questions to California, and that these are some of the questions that I think will be asked as we look at the final decision that the redistricting committee will make on its maps. Is it inclusive? Or has it been exclusive? And is the data substantial enough to justify the change in minority representation and leadership in this state of California?
Well, Assemblyman Mike Davis, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the bill AB 420, which my guest Assemblyman Mike Davis is sponsoring. He's the vice chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, a member of the Assembly Rules Committee, and serves as Assistant Majority Whip. And that does it for our program today. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "An individual has not started living until he can rise above the narrow confines of his individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity." That's King. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. Want to congratulate our winners for the tickets to the LA Rising concert. Edward from Huntington Park and John from Pasadena won the tickets. And the answer to the question, the names of the bass guitarist and the drummer from Rage Against the Machine are Tim Comerford and Brad Wilk, respectively. Tickets are still available at LARisingFestival.com. Special thanks to Golden Voice for donating tickets to tomorrow's concert. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Laura Mann is our intern. Tamika Miller is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Join us at Facebook.com/UprisingRadio. Follow us at Twitter.com/UprisingRadio. Visit our website at UprisingRadio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday at 8.